There's one matter which Mr. Suckling did not have time to cover, but I want to cover before covering the topic for today, which is the Book of Amos. And that is the matter that, as a consequence of Jehu's rebellion, Jehu, of course, wiped out, by wiping out all the Baal worshippers, the top civil and military leadership of the nation of Israel. They were all removed, you might say, with one stroke. This left Israel in a very vulnerable position. Now, that vulnerability need not have been a problem if Jehu had done everything that would have been pleasing to God. Israel's physical vulnerability would not have led to disaster, because God is certainly able to save a people, whether they be few or many. Jonathan understood that when he attacked the garrison of the Philistines. David understood it, and certainly even Asa, when he fought Zerah the Ethiopian, understood it as well. But the area where Jehu drew the line was that he refused to do away with the corrupt form of Yahweh worship, which was the dominant form of Yahweh worship in the north. He got rid of all the Baal worship, but he refused to get rid of the golden calf. He drew the line at that point, refusing to end that system. And as a result, God was pleased with him to a point, but not totally. Now, did Mr. Suckling cover that? A little bit, okay. Because it says in the text itself that because he did not reverse the sin of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, in which he caused Israel to sin, he said that his sons would sit on the throne up and through the fourth generation, but that because he stopped at that point, and didn't get rid of that sinful form of worship, that would be as far as his family would enjoy control of the throne, and also he would bring a horrible destruction upon the nation of Israel. And it didn't take, God didn't have to search around for an instrument, because Israel was so vulnerable, politically and militarily speaking. Aram saw a natural advantage in expanding at this time. And this is where Hazael, of course, enters the picture. And Hazael did treat the Israelites with a great deal of cruelty. And in fact, Israel sunk down to the lowest position it was to be at under the domination of Hazael prior to the final Assyrian extinction of the nation. That was probably the lowest single point that they reached. But it says in 2 Kings 13, if we turn there for a moment, that in beginning in verse 3, well, let's back it up to the first verse. In the 23rd year of Joash the son of Ahaziah, king of Judah, Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, began to reign over Israel in Samaria, and he reigned for 17 years. He did that which was evil in the sight of the Eternal, and followed the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which made Israel to sin. He departed not therefrom, that golden calf worship. And the anger of the Eternal was kindled against Israel, and he delivered them into the hand of Hazael, the king of Aram, and into the hand of Ben-Hadad, this would be the third Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael, all their days. Now, Hazael is a personal name. As I mentioned earlier in another lecture, the term Ben-Hadad is just that. It's a term. It's not a personal name. It's like a term like son of David. In this case, it's son of the god Hadad, in this case. But this would be the third individual that we find in the Bible that is referred to by that particular term. But Jehoahaz besought the Eternal, and the Eternal hearkened to him, for he saw the oppression of Israel, because the king of Aram oppressed them. And the Eternal gave Israel a savior, so that they went out from under the hand of the Arameans. And the children of Israel dwelt in their tents as before time. Now, how did God give them a savior? Remember, the term savior, we usually think of in terms of spiritual salvation. The term Savior is used in connection with the judges whom God raised up to deliver Israel from their oppressions during that period of time. But in this case, it appears that the Savior God provided was not an Israelite at all. That God brought an outsider into the picture who so thoroughly thrashed the Aramean kingdom that they had to let go of Israelite territory, and Israel then found relief. This outside figure was the Assyrian ruler Adad-nirari III. That's a mouthful, I know. Adad-nirari III. A-D-A-D-N-I-R-A-R-I III. We have uncovered inscriptions from his reign where he recalls that he subdued Damascus, forcing Damascus to become tributary to Assyria, forcing that king to personally pay tribute. And it's interesting that this was the second time, apparently, that Damascus was subdued by the Assyrians. And as I said, in the process, they had to let go of Israel, and Israel was able to stage a comeback. And we find that that comeback occurred in the days of Jehoahaz's son, whose name was Joash, the same as the king of Judah at the same time. Now, this Joash was able to physically take action against the Arameans, as it explains in the rest of this chapter. And he was able to recover large portions of Israelite territory because Aram had been so badly thrashed by the Assyrians. Notice in verse 25 that Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, took again out of the hand of Ben-Hadad, this would be the third Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael, the cities which he had taken out of the hand of Jehoahaz, his father, by war. Three times did Joash beat him and recovered the cities of Israel. And so we begin to get a renaissance, physically speaking, taking place in the nation of Israel. They are recovering vital cities on vital trade routes. They are beginning to enter a new realm of prosperity. And we begin to now come to the third great alliance, or third great period of power for the two Israelite kingdoms. Simultaneously, as Joash was beginning to revive the northern kingdom, we find that in the days of Amaziah, who was now becoming the new king of Judah in chapter 14, that there was a revival of the kingdom of Judah militarily. And they reconquered Edom. Now, why would they be interested in reconquering Edom? Notice in verse 7, he slew of Edom in the Valley of Saul 10,000 and took Selah by war. Why is it that there is an interest in controlling Edom? What does that do? Right. Edom controls the king's highway leading to the Red Sea, which is, whenever Israel and Judah were separate countries and they were allied, it was Judah that controlled Edom, and it was Israel that controlled Moab, and usually the Arameans. That's how they divided up the necessity of controlling this whole king's highway together. And so we find that after he had taken Edom, remember, Joash had already begun recovering land at the expense of the Arameans in the northern part of the king's highway, and Amaziah has now recovered Edom, the southern part of the king's highway. It says, Amaziah sent messengers to Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, king of Israel, saying, come, let us look one another in the face. And of course, this is not exactly that they want to just talk. Amaziah got a bit too big for his britches, and he was thinking that he could subdue the northern kingdom and secure Judah's prosperity just by conquering the whole area. And as a result, you know, Amaziah was badly defeated. And Judah really was plundered by the Israelites. They really suffered very badly. When we come down, though, to the next pair of kings, the animosity disappears. They realize the geopolitical graphic realities dictate they have to work together if they're both to prosper. And I want you to have embedded in your mind that the key to prosperity in the period of the divided monarchy requires a political alliance between Israel and Judah, and a link up with the Phoenician cities so they're tied into their maritime trading network. And so after the animosity between Joash and Amaziah has passed, we come to Jeroboam II, who is the ruler in the north, and Uzziah, or Azariah, both names are given in the scripture for him, who is the ruler of Judah. And they form an alliance, and together they conquer all the surrounding areas, and they restore the prosperity to their two kingdoms. Notice in case of Jeroboam II, it talks about him here in 2 Kings 14, verse 25, he restored the coast, meaning the borders of Israel, from the entering of Hamath, which is up in the north near the Euphrates River, onto the Sea of the Plain, the Mediterranean Sea, according to the word of the eternal God of Israel, which he spoke by the hand of his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet, which was of Gath-Hepher. And so we have a restoration of the glories of the Israelite kingdoms. They control everything from the Euphrates down to the borders of Moab, including Moab, I should say. And then Judah has contributed the control of Edom. They control the Philistines as well. And they are linked up, we know from history, with a commercial alliance with the Phoenician cities. And so great prosperity begins to typify the northern and the southern kingdoms. But although there is great prosperity, spiritually, the nation was sick. And in fact, you can make a New Testament analogy to the spiritual condition of the nation of Israel at this peak period of prosperity. In fact, if you measure the three great periods of prosperity, Solomon's was the greatest, by far. But the two others, the time of Omri and Ahab and Jehoshaphat, and now the time of Jeroboam and Uzziah, it's this third one which was after Solomon was the most prosperous. Omri's and Ahab's was glorious, but this was even more glorious in terms of prosperity. But spiritually, the nation was very sick. Yet the nation was convinced, I'm talking now about the northern kingdom, the northern kingdom of Israel was convinced that they had this prosperity as a blessing from God, that they had a covenant relationship with God that was very special, and God was well pleased with them, and God therefore had given them this prosperity as his blessing, as the seal of his approval on their doings. And so although they were rich and increased with goods, they were poor spiritually, blind spiritually, naked spiritually. So you can very easily make an analogy of the nation of Israel in the days of Jeroboam II to a Laodicean condition. But although they seemed to have much, they really were, where it counts, very poor. And Amos was assigned to be the prophet that was to rebuke the northern kingdom in this period, and to show them that unless they repented, they would be destroyed. Now, Amos could have criticized the northern kingdom for a lot of its spiritual failures. But it's interesting that God did not inspire him to attack what would seem to be the most obvious. God did not inspire Amos to attack them for their golden calf worship. What God inspired Amos to do was to attack them for their crimes of social injustice. God inspired Amos to emphasize that Israel fell short of truly pleasing God in the area of social injustice. And that's why Amos is sometimes nicknamed the prophet of social justice, because that is the main concern of the book. the lack of social justice in the northern kingdom. Now, in the book of Amos, Amos's status is given in chapter 7. Although in the current translations which we have available to us, the King James and probably also the New King James, and I don't think the RSV is any better, it obscures it somewhat. It is possible that Amos delivered the content of this entire book in a very brief period of time. It was a short work that he was commissioned to do. And one of the places where he publicly rebuked the people was, of course, where they tended to come on their pilgrimage festivals. And I suspect that the time setting was the time setting around Pentecost. Now, why Pentecost? Because it is a summer festival. You'll see why a little later I suggest a summer festival. But let's look in chapter 7 and catch the rebuke that was given to Amos by the high priest who served there at Bethel. Let's pick up the story in chapter 7, verse 10. Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, sent to Jeroboam, the king of Israel, saying, Amos has conspired against you in the midst of the house of Israel. The land is not able to bear all his words. In other words, the words of Amos were so strong, the denunciation was so total, that he says the land can't stand it. For Amos says that Jeroboam shall die by the sword, and Israel shall surely be led away captive out of their own land. Now that's an exaggeration. Amos nowhere said that Jeroboam himself would die by the sword. He did say that unless Israel repented, Israel would be led away captive out of their own land. Now we come to the crucial verses 12, 13, and 14. Amaziah said to Amos, look, you seer, go flee away to the land of Judah, and there eat bread and prophesy there. Amaziah is making an assumption. Amaziah is making the assumption that Amos is a prophet by profession. And that's what he means, eat bread and prophesy in Judah. Earn your living as a prophet in Judah. Don't try to earn your living as a prophet here. Because we're not interested, in other words, in what you have to say. Go down there to the kingdom of Judah where they're sort of envious of us, jealous of us, and maybe people will pay you to hear you badmouth us down there. But you can't expect to earn a living by badmouthing us up here. But don't prophesy anymore at Bethel, because it's the king's chapel and the king's court. Now, Amos answers this allegation, and he answers it directly. The allegation is that Amos is a professional prophet. The term in Hebrew for a professional prophet is a ben navi. A professional anything is a ben something. For instance, a professional metal worker would be called a Ben Kain, or Cain, a Ben Cain. A snake charmer would be a Ben Nahash. The term Ben denotes professional status. And it's not hard to understand why, because the term Ben means son, you see. Normally, children followed in the footsteps of their father's profession. That's why to be a professional was to be a ben something. Now, the term ben navi, navi of course means prophet, would be the son of a prophet. That doesn't mean necessarily you are literally a prophet's son. It means, a technical term, that you are a professional prophet. Now, if we look at verse 14, what Amos says, and we translate it from the Hebrew, it should probably more accurately be rendered, no, I am not a Ben Navi. I am a Navi. Now, what is the point that Amos is making? He says, actually, he says it in the reverse order. He says, no, I am a prophet. I am not a Ben Navi. In other words, I am the genuine article, a prophet called of God. I am not a paid professional who said, hey, paid professional prophets earn good dough. I think I'll make myself into a professional prophet. That's what he's saying. You've got it all wrong, Amaziah. I'm not a paid professional. I am the genuine article, the one called by God. And then he goes on to offer the proof. By profession, I was a herdman and a gatherer of sycamore fruit. But the Eternal took me as I followed the flock, and the Eternal said, go prophesy to my people Israel. You see, I'm the real thing. You've got it all wrong. So this is his position. Not a professional, a paid professional as he was perceived to be, but the genuine article uniquely called of God. Now the time setting, of course, is given in Amos chapter 1, verse 1, that it concerned events concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, the king of Judah, and the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. Now, the book, as I said, is employed as a diatribe, a denunciation of the northern kingdom of Israel. But the book opens in a very peculiar way, if that's its purpose. Because what does the book begin with? Amos's message does not begin with a denunciation of the northern kingdom of Israel. Amos's message begins with a denunciation of Aram Damascus in verse 3. And it's a message from God saying that for three transgressions of Damascus and for four, actually, as the marginal reference shows you, there's that word and again. Remember I told you the word and in Hebrew can be translated into another English word? Do you remember what that other English word was? Even. And the marginal reference I have says, instead of and for four, it says yea for four, which yea is just an old English way of saying even. You see, this is the way it really should be translated. For three transgressions, even for four, which is a literary expression. It doesn't mean three literal transgressions or four literal ones. It is an expression using two numbers, one being the second number, four, being, of course, one greater than three. In other words, for sufficient reasons would be three transgressions. Three transgressions means for sufficient reasons. Yea, for four, for even more than sufficient reasons. That's what God is saying. It's a literary expression, which we've been able to recover by studying the surrounding languages and how these expressions are used. I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they threshed Gilead with threshing instruments of iron. I will send a fire into the house of Hazael, which was the royal family, which shall devour the palaces of Ben-Hadad, you know, the title that the kings of Damascus held. Then notice there's a second denunciation. For three transgressions of Gaza, even for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. So Gaza comes in for denunciation. Then in verse 9, a third denunciation. This one against the city of Tyre. Then there's a fourth one in verse 11, a denunciation of Edom. Then in verse 13, there is a fifth denunciation, this one for Ammon. Then in chapter 2, we find it opening with the sixth denunciation. An awful lot is going over the dam, and Amos hasn't even gotten to the heart of his message yet. This is a denunciation of Moab. And then, in seventh position, there is a denunciation of Judah. It is only in chapter 2, verse 6, that God inspires Amos to get down to what is the real message, the denunciation of Israel. And it is significant that Israel's denunciation comes in the eighth position. Because among these peoples, the number eight had great significance. It's one greater than what? Seven. Seven is a sign of completeness in their culture. And this means even more than completeness. It was a way of saying to the people who heard the message, God views you to be the worst of the worst, the ultimate sinners. And that's the way they would have understood it. Because the number eight was employed as a superlative, either being the best of the best, or, in this case, the worst of the worst, the worst of the sinners. And so God inspired Amos's message to employ this stratagem as a way of indicating his displeasure. Now, what is it that specifically is mentioned here in verse 6 of chapter 2? For three transgressions of Israel, yea, for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they sold the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of shoes. What it means to sell the righteous for silver is to pervert judgment. That a righteous man has a case against a wicked man before the judge, and the judge takes a bribe. And therefore, he denies the case of the righteous man. This is what it means to sell the righteous for silver. What does it mean to sell the poor for a pair of shoes? Well, it needs to be linked up with the next verse, because it's really part of the same thought. That pant after the dust of the earth on the head of the poor. Can you think of a more apt description of somebody who is excessively greedy, who wants the uttermost farthing, that he even lusts after the worthless dust that accumulates on the head of a poor person as he trudges the roads, since he has no other means of transportation? That's how grasping and greedy they are. And this ties in with this description of selling the poor for a pair of shoes. A man owes a debt, he cannot repay it. God's law says the creditor can have him sold into slavery for his debt. But what kind of a debt do they exact this very dire punishment for? A debt that is so trifling, it would just suffice to buy a pair of shoes. And yet the creditor screams and rages, I want this man sold, that I may have this debt repaid. This is obviously a picture of extreme hardness of heart, as well as of great injustice. Notice what is said in verse 8, and see if you can get the point of what is described. They, meaning the unrighteous of Israel, lay themselves down upon clothes laid to pledge by every altar. Remember what it says in God's law about a garment taken as security for a loan? That's what a pledge is, it's the security. What kind of a person gives his robe as security for a loan? Yeah, because that's all he has of value left. He has nothing else of any value to give as a pledge. And God's law was very specific. You shall not keep that garment overnight, because that's his only covering. He's going to lie out on the ground somewhere. He doesn't have a house, and that's the only thing he has to cover himself with. So you must give it back to him. Even though that's your only security for the loan, God says give it back to him before nightfall so he can cover himself and be warm. And don't worry about your security, in other words. Trust me. And even if you lose it, we'll chalk it up to profit and loss. far better to do that than to deny a man who is so poor his only protection against the cold. Now here are people that have broken God's law, specifically given, about garments taken to pledge. They have retained them against the law of God. And what are they doing? They are kneeling before the altar that they claim is an altar to Yahweh, in the act of showing, look how faithful I am to you, Yahweh. I'm here before your altar, laying out the sacrifices you've commanded. And because you kneel down on the stone ground, it's kind of hard. You know, you cushion your feet with something, your knees with something. What are they using to cushion their knees with? Garments illegally against the law of God that they have retained. So the very moment that they claim they are faithfully observing what God has commanded by offering him his sacrifices, they deny the very fact that they are faithful by the very garments that they cushion their knees with. It's a very strong analogy, very direct. God speaks to this matter of social justice, particularly in chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 7. You who turn judgment to wormwood. What's wormwood? What is it that causes God to use that particular kind of wood? Well, it has a bitterness to it, but it's useless. It cannot be used for any productive purpose in terms of carpentry work. And that's what God is saying. You who turn judgment to wormwood, to worthlessness, and leave off righteousness in the earth, seek him that makes the seven stars in Orion and turns the shadow of death into the morning and makes the day dark with night, that calls for the waters of the sea and pours them out on the face of the earth. The Eternal is his name. They say, those of you who are perverting judgment, turn and really seek God. Notice in verse 10, they hate him that rebukes in the gate. They abhor him that speaks uprightly. It's like in the Psalms, you get a repetitive statement in slightly different words. It's the same thought, but slightly different words. That those few people left, remember, in the gate is where judgment is carried out. That's where the legal cases are decided. There's somebody there who stands up and says, no, that's not just. There are a few doing that. And how are those people received? They are rebuked by the officials. They are abhorred. The people, that few people left who stand for righteousness, are abhorred by the many. For as much as your treading is upon the poor, you've taken from him burdens of wheat. You've built houses of hewn stone, but you shall not dwell in them. You have planted pleasant vineyards, but you shall not drink the wine of them. For I know your manifold transgressions and your mighty sins. You afflict the just. You take a bribe. You turn aside the poor in the gate from their right, which is, of course, judgment and justice. He says, if you want me to turn from my purpose of punishment, seek good and not evil that you may live. Hate the evil and love the good. Establish justice in the gate. And it may be that the Eternal God of hosts will be gracious to the remnant of Joseph. This is, of course, the only way they're going to spare themselves from the coming calamity. Chapter 4, verse 1, gives another analogy of injustice. Hear you this word, you kine of Bashan, you fat cattle of Bashan, that are in the mountain of Samaria, which oppress the poor and crush the needy, which say to their masters, bring and let us have drink. He's talking about the women of Samaria, luxury-loving women, who say, yes, go out and see how many more poor people you can oppress so we might have another glass of wine at their profit. A very tremendous amount of callousness that is being described here. Then there is the matter in chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 4. Hear you this, you that swallow up the needy, even to make the poor of the land be gone, to fail, saying, when will the new moon be gone, that we may sell corn, and the Sabbath that we may set forth wheat, making the ephah small and the shekel great, falsifying the balances by deceit? They are so greedy to go back into business with their false balances, which cheat the buyer. They can't wait for the Sabbath to be over so they can go back to cheating the poor again. They can't wait for the new moon, which was a day of rest by their own practice, to be over so they could open up the shops again and cheat the people again. They were so eager to get back at it. It wasn't just they were doing it, they were so eager to get back at it. That we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes. They're repeating that analogy again. So social injustice forms the heart of it. But there is also a second point which God rebukes them for. And that is, of course, as I said, their false religiosity. We saw that in chapter 2, verse 8, where while they claim to be obeying God, their very actions as they offer the sacrifice show that they don't, laying on those garments taken to pledge. But notice also in chapter 5, verse 21, I hate, I despise your feast days, I will not smell in your solemn assemblies. Though you offer me burnt offerings and your meat offerings, I will not accept them, neither I'll regard the peace offerings of your fat feasts. This is not specifically a reference to their idolatrous worship. That's not the point which is mainly involved here. Because God says, rather take away from me the noise of your songs, I will not hear the melody of your instruments, but let judgment run down as waters and righteousness as a mighty stream. In other words, he's again, he's linking the matter of the lack of social justice and their false religiosity, you see. He's saying, rather than have sacrifice done according to all your rituals, do the works of the law. Do justice. That's what I want. Then the third major problem these people had is they believed they were God's pet people. And therefore, they didn't have to listen to a prophet like Amos because God would never send them captive out of their land. They were God's pet people, and captivity from them was impossible. God speaks to this idea in chapter 9, verse 7. Are you not as the Ethiopians to me, O children of Israel? Have I not brought Israel out of the land of Egypt, the Philistines from Kaphtor, the Arameans from Kir? Behold, the eyes of the eternal God are upon the sinful kingdom, and I will destroy it from off the face of the earth, saving I will not utterly destroy the house of Jacob, says the eternal. You trust that you have a special relationship with me that means I can't punish you. But that's not true, he's telling these people. Back in chapter 5 again, verse 18. Woe unto you that desire the day of the eternal. With their false ideas about their special relationship with God, they look forward to the day of eternal as a day of their exaltation and the putting down of all their enemies. And what does God tell them? He says, woe to you that desire that day. To what end will it be for you? That day is darkness and not light. That's a day of judgment, not just for your enemies, but for you. So you're stupid to desire that and look forward to it. Because you're not so special, I can't punish you. And then Amos employs a number of literary plays on words to illustrate the blindness of the people to the fact that God is able to punish them and is even beginning to punish them. Notice this in chapter 7. I'm sorry, not chapter 7. Chapter 6, verse 13. You which rejoice in a thing of naught, which say, have we not taken to us horns by our own strength? Now, horns were viewed as a symbol of power and strength, which is one reason why the bull was so commonly worshipped in the ancient world. And it was even a sense of divine strength and power. For instance, there was a king in Mesopotamia who attempted to be worshipped as a god, and he had himself pictured with horns, symbolizing his divine strength. It's a play on words, though. You that rejoice in something which is really nothing, saying we've taken horns by our own power, we have been our own saviors by our own physical military powers. They were rejoicing in two military victories which they had achieved at the expense of the Arameans of Damascus. The first one was at a town called Lo Debar. That's the Hebrew name of the town. If you translated it into English, it would be a thing of naught, a word of no account. There was a second town that they had a victory at. It was the town Karnaim, which is horns. You see, so it's a play on words. That's why it is legitimately translated, because it's a play on words. It's meant to be a message. You rejoice in something which is nothing and claim that you've taken horns of strength by your own power. And it's a play on these two military victories that Israel won at the expense of the Arameans. Now, what is the purpose of this play? Why is Amos rebuking them for being stupid and taking pleasure or credit for these victories? Where does a powerful nation fight its battles in war? In the territory of the enemy or on their own soil? These two towns are located deep within Israelite territory. That's the point of Amos's rebuke. Is how can you become so proud and boastful about how strong you are as a nation, how unbeatable, when you're already fighting battles on your own soil? That should tell you alone that your power is waning, not that it's great. But you don't recognize it. You take pride in these victories when they should symbolize your weakness. This is what the term means. The second is in chapter 8, verses 1 and 2. Thus says the Eternal God, behold, a basket of summer fruit. And he says to Amos, what do you see? And he said, a basket of summer fruit. And the Eternal said to me, the end is come upon my Israel, my people Israel. I will not again pass by them anymore. There's a play on words here. Summer fruit, the word for summer is kayetz. The word for end is ketz. And remember, in Hebrew, you don't deal with vowels when you write. You write with the consonants and add the vowels additionally. So it's two words from the same Hebrew root, K-T-Z, summer and end. There's the play on words. That, you know, just as you have a basket of summer fruit, let that symbolize the end is come upon Israel. The ketz has come upon Israel. It's a play on words in the Hebrew. And so Amos attacked them, as I said, primarily for their social injustice, their false religiosity, which they thought could satisfy God despite the lack of justice. As long as they did the rituals right, God would be satisfied. And third, well, we're God's pet people. We can't be punished. There's really nothing we have to fear. And he was showing them they were wrong. And I think that we need to leave the book of Amos as a watchword for ourselves. Because unless we are careful, we can think of ourselves as being so special to God that he can't punish us, that we can mistake our fidelity with how we keep the Sabbath and how punctiliously we tithe and so forth for the real essence of religion, which is described to us in James and in 1 John 3:16, the service of our brethren. And we can become blind to acts of social injustice as well. But Amos, for all of his rebukes, was inspired by God to leave the people with some consolation. Chapter 9, verse 9, 11 through 15. For lo, I command, and I will sift the house of Israel among all nations as grain in a sieve. You shall not, yet not, shall not the least grain fall upon the earth. And then he says in verse 11 through 15, in that day, will I raise up the tabernacle of David that is fallen, and close up the breaches thereof. I will raise up the ruins and build it as the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Edom and of the heathen which are called by my name. Behold, the days come, says the Eternal, that the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes him that soweth seed. We talked about that in historical geography class as an analogy of extreme fruitfulness because of the way the seasons run. And so God ends his message to Amos with an element of hope, that even if he must punish them, it will only be for a time, and there will be a period of revival.